From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! After Newt Gingrich announces his resignation, the battle opens for leadership of the Republicans. We'll look at Newt Gingrich and Louisiana Congressmember Bob Livingston. As the British House of Lords continues hearings on the ex-dictator Augusto Pinochet, we'll talk to two victims of the Chilean regime, the sister of Orlando Letelier and father of Ronnie Moffitt. Letelier and Moffitt were killed in a car bomb set by Chilean agents in Washington at the height of the Pinochet regime. And a tribute to my father, George Goodman. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. According to senior Clinton administration officials quoted in the New York Times, the United States is closer to bombing Iraq than it has been since the Gulf War. One official told the Times the U.S. will, quote, obliterate Iraq in the event of airstrikes. The Pentagon says it has developed two options for attacks on Iraq, sharp and swift, or a larger, more punishing assault that would require more U.S. forces to be sent to the region. Meanwhile, today, an Iraqi official said that a U.S. bombing campaign could not kill more people than U.S.-led United Nations sanctions kill in Iraq every day. President Clinton is continuing to meet with his national security advisors and Pentagon officials. We'll follow these events as they unfold. With the endorsements of top Republicans in his pocket, Representative Robert Livingston of Louisiana all but declared himself Speaker of the House today, 2 days after the abrupt resignation of Speaker Newt Gingrich. Meanwhile, California House Republican Christopher Cox said today he's dropped his bid to succeed Gingrich. This news from Afghanistan. Afghanistan's Taliban movement today challenged the United States to prove by November 20th that Saudi dissident Osama bin Laden was a terrorist. The Taliban's Supreme Court told the Afghan Islamic Press news agency that if no proof was submitted by the deadline, he would be deemed innocent of all charges of terrorism. The court said it would investigate bin Laden after intense Western pressure to extradite the Saudi dissident. A coalition led by a former coup leader in Venezuela has become the top force in Venezuela's new Congress, a major setback for the two political parties that have ruled for 40 years. With two-thirds of Sunday's vote counted, Hugo Chavez's Patriotic Pole coalition had won 34% of the congressional seats. The 44-year-old Chavez, an independent supported by millions of peasants and shantytown dwellers, is the favorite to win the December 6th presidential election. In 92, he staged an unsuccessful military revolt against the government and became a hero to many for denouncing corruption and speaking out on behalf of the poor. He spent 2 years in prison and was released in 1994 by the country's president. Despite Israel's agreement to stick to the timetable of the Y peace negotiation, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said today he will not move forward until the Palestinians do more to combat, quote, Islamic militants. Netanyahu's senior advisor said Israel will probably not begin its phased troop withdrawal from 13% of the West Bank on November 16th, as stipulated by the Land for Security in accord with the Palestinians. Nicaragua's ambassador to the United States yesterday estimated it would cost $1 billion to rebuild his country after Hurricane Mitch, and appealed for massive reconstruction assistance and debt relief measures. Ambassador Francisco Aguirre Sacasa told CNN the hurricane killed 4,000 Nicaraguans and left 800,000 people, about 20% of the country's population, homeless. Mitch killed an estimated 11,000 people in Central America and left thousands more homeless after crashing through the region a week ago. A South African prosecutor said today President Nelson Mandela's ex-wife and two former security force generals named in a recent report on apartheid-era abuses are under criminal investigation. Statements by the prosecutor were the clearest sign yet that the South African government would bring criminal cases against individuals that the Truth Commission implicated in killings and other violations of human rights. The commission can grant amnesty to those who admit their guilt and are found to have acted on political motives. The commission has stated that individuals who have not sought amnesty should be prosecuted. Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams today dismissed as mischief-making weekend media reports of Irish Republican Army disarmament moves. Adams' remarks on BBC Radio came ahead of his talks with British Prime Minister Tony Blair, scheduled for today. Weekend newspapers reported that the IRA military wing of the Sinn Féin party would soon call a conference to decide whether to bow to disarmament demands. And this news from Indonesia. Anti-government demonstrators held several protests in the capital, Jakarta, today, the eve of a special session of the country's top legislative body. Witnesses said two students were injured when police broke up a rally near the presidential palace. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Newt Gingrich's abrupt resignation from his post as House Speaker this past Friday caught many by surprise. But for conservative Republicans, it was the desired outcome of a campaign to oust the Speaker, whom they thought is being too accommodating to moderates. Now, Congressmember Robert Livingston of Louisiana, the House Appropriations Committee chair, has all but declared himself the new House Speaker after he and Representative Christopher Cox of California lobbied fellow Republicans over the weekend for support for their candidacies. Cox announced today he's dropped his bid to succeed Gingrich. Just who is Bob Livingston, and what can we expect from him as House Speaker? A hard conservative on social issues, including abortion rights and the use of English only, he was elected to the House of Representatives in a special election in 1977, becoming the first Republican to represent Louisiana's first congressional district in over 100 years. Here to tell us more about him, as well as the overall battle by the Republicans for leadership, is Gary Ruskin from the Congressional Accountability Project. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Gary.
Thanks for having me on the show, Amy.
Well, before we talk about Bob Livingston, I wanted to go back and look at what's happened with Gingrich and why this abrupt resignation, not only as House Speaker, but his resignation of his seat in Georgia.
Well, I think there's a wide dissatisfaction within the Republican Party, and particularly within the House of Representatives, over the performance of the Speaker during the last 2 years. I think it's widely felt that Republicans have been misled and that they have not been able to put forth much of a message during the last 2 years. Many Republicans feel that there has been way too much emphasis on the impeachment process to the detriment of a legislative agenda. This was really a do-nothing Congress, and consequently, there was very little for Republicans to run on during this election cycle, and they did astonishingly badly. They did not pick up any Senate seats and lost 5 seats in the House of Representatives, and following that electoral catastrophe, the dissatisfaction which had been rumbling during the last 2 years about the Speaker just erupted in a remarkably quick fashion. Livingston declared his candidacy for Speaker, and then Gingrich folded very, very quickly.
Now, Gingrich had to know how the American people felt, if polls are any indication, over the last 9 months or so, in terms of the whole idea of impeachment and people feeling fed up around the country, Republican and Democrat. Why didn't he respond earlier?
Well, Gingrich has, I think, a profound hatred of the president as well. He, some accounts say that one of the reasons why he wanted to push impeachment so hard was that he felt that after he had suffered the sanction from the House Ethics Committee, that the president should undergo a similar and similarly harsh process. And so those are big reasons. Plus, there's a big wing of the Republican Party, which the Speaker is quite close to, which wants to impeach the president at all costs. And this is much of the of the core of the Republican Party these days. And so he wanted to excite those voters, and has been talking about impeachment a great deal since then.
You know, I get the sense that there's going to be a sort of softening of Newt Gingrich's image as he leads to the end of his term. He won't be coming back in January. I mean, you see the picture on the front page of the New York Times, him hugging his neighbor in Marietta, Georgia, before he goes out to meet the press. But Gary Ruskin, you at the Congressional Accountability Project has perhaps brought more complaints against Newt Gingrich than anyone else. If you can talk a little about his history and also the fact that there was another attempted coup of Newt Gingrich last year, which ultimately failed and led to the resignation of Congressmember Paxson from upstate New York, who's now going for, according to the latest reports, the head of the Republican National Committee.
Sure. Well, a brief history of the Speaker. Well, he started out with a PhD in European history, taught history in Georgia, lost twice in election races for the House in 74 and 76, won finally in 78. And then early on in the early 80s, he started something called the Conservative Opportunity Society, which was a way for backbench Republicans to sort of express their views in a visible way and to coalesce on some platform matters, which would later become prominent in the 90s. In 86, he gained control of a political action committee called GOPAC and turned it into a way of training state house candidates for the Congress, and that he rode to victory in 1994. It was that GOPAC played a central role in the ability of Republicans to take control of the House and the Senate in the 94 elections, which were also very notable for his strategic idea of having a contract with America, which was this 10-point platform, which nationalized the election, and Gingrich was elected Speaker at the beginning of 95. One of the most notable things about Gingrich was that immediately after he became the putative Speaker in November of 94, he immediately cashed in, or tried to cash in, with a $4.5 million advance from HarperCollins Publishing to write two books from a company owned by Rupert Murdoch. There's a lot of history to tell, but briefly, one of his most famous gaffes in 95 was, which I think really turned a lot of the American public away from him, was how he complained that he, when he was treated rudely by President Clinton on a trip on Air Force One back to the United States, at the same time there was the government shutdown. But it's important to note how much of just a rule breaker Speaker Gingrich was. He had very little respect for the basic rules and laws which govern our democracy. He has repeatedly been found in violation of House ethics rules, just the basic rules which make democracy possible. Just last month, he was found in violation of a very important rule regarding that prevents influence peddling. I myself have filed three ethics complaints against him regarding this very same rule, one about how he allowed telecommunications entrepreneur Donald Jones to work on the telecommunications bill of 94, which was probably the most important bill in that Congress, allowed this telecommunications entrepreneur to work on the telecom bill for the speaker in the speaker's offices while he was a telecommunications executive. And that's absolutely inappropriate. Another complaint that we brought against the speaker had to do with a man named Joseph Gaylord, who was the speaker's top political aide, but by many accounts, he did then and still does run the speaker's office, which is completely inappropriate because it leaves the speaker's office wide open to influence peddling. But the speaker's been charged with violations of other House rules, found to have violated other House rules many, many other times before. For example, in 95, regarding the speaker's book deal, the Ethics Committee said that it strongly questions the appropriateness of what some could describe as an attempt by you to capitalize on your office. At a minimum, this creates the impression of exploiting one's office for political gain. Such a perception is especially troubling when it pertains to the office of the Speaker of the House. But I guess most important is his complete unwillingness to obey a basic rule that prevents influence peddling, called House Rule 45, which prevents the outside funding of congressional offices. So he has this pattern of rule breaking, which we'll be very happy to see disappear, because that kind of disrespect for the basic rules of government really destroys the ability of the Congress and the government to work fairly.
We're talking to Gary Ruskin. He's head of the Congressional Accountability Project, brought three complaints himself against Newt Gingrich, the Speaker of the House, ethics complaints, as we go through Newt Gingrich's history to get an accurate picture of the current House Speaker. But we would be remiss if we didn't also look at the record of the man who, at least at this point, looks like he may be replacing him. And of course, it is still early, too early to absolutely make the prediction. But Bob Livingston of Louisiana has been in the Congress for more than two decades. Gary Ruskin, can you talk a little about his record and the ways in which he is similar to Newt Gingrich and the ways in which he's different? But let's stick to the record, because so much of this weekend, as I've been watching television, it's all about the atmosphere, the climate, the kind of person. What about how he's voted and what he's done in Congress?
Well, Bob Livingston is a very conservative man. He was elected in 1977. He's been the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. His tenure at the Appropriations Committee has mostly been that of trying to fight off his Republican colleagues from attaching many, many crazy legislative riders, and has just tried to, insofar as he can, for the most part, present bills, appropriations bills that could pass without these legislative riders, which play to the very most right wing. He is most notable, I think, for his warfare on the institutions that police corruption in the Congress. He has led an assault on the Federal Election Commission that's been quite astonishing. The Federal Election Commission is a bulwark against legislative corruption. Livingston, as from his seat as chairman of that House Appropriations Committee, has starved the Federal Election Commission of badly needed investigative resources. He's repeatedly denied requests by the FEC for more funds to hire more investigators and more lawyers, which could help police corruption both in the Congress and in presidential elections. He's tried to cut the size of the press office in the FEC from 5 to 2, which is just ridiculous. And the reason why he doesn't like the FEC press office is they tell reporters and the public about how about the sources of campaign funds for members of Congress, and that's bad for really both parties, but particularly for the Republican Party, because they are brought up to their necks in a lot of cases by corporate and wealthy special interests. And he's also attached, and during this Congress, he attached an appropriations bill this year that would have had the effect of firing the general counsel of the FEC, Larry Noble, who has tried to aggressively go after violators of campaign finance laws and rules. In addition to his astonishing assault on the Federal Election Commission, he during this Congress, conducted a very successful assault on the House ethics process. Livingston was the co-chairman of something called the House Ethics Reform Task Force, which was charged with changing the rules that govern the internal policing of corruption in the House of Representatives, changing how the House Ethics Committee works. His task force, which passed rules in September of 97, made it much more unlikely for House members to ever undergo a thorough investigation for corruption or influence peddling or abuse of power. His main change was that he made it nearly impossible for citizens to file ethics complaints in the House. With these new rules, no citizen has been able to file an ethics complaint in the House during this Congress. It's a total lockout.
And Gary, we're going to have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we're going to come back to your description of the record of Bob Livingston, who at least at this point is the front runner to replace Newt Gingrich as Speaker of the House, and these quite remarkable developments that have taken place over the last few days since Friday when Newt Gingrich announced that he was resigning both his seat and the speakership. Gary Ruskin is head of the Congressional Accountability Project. We'll be back with him here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at the record of Robert Livingston, who is the Louisiana Congress member, at least at this point, most likely to succeed Newt Gingrich, who has said he is resigning as both Speaker of the House, also resigning his seat in Georgia, which will lead to a special election for that seat that he just ran for and won a week ago. I'm actually looking at Bob Livingston's bio. This is his own list of his accomplishments. And in that list of accomplishments, it says he's the author of the federal three strikes law, which puts three-time convicted violent felons in prison for life without chance of parole. He expanded the Hyde anti-abortion language to cover health maintenance organizations, halted federal funds for fetal tissue research, and prevented federal health programs from funding abortions. He prohibited OSHA from issuing new standards on ergonomics, regulations that have cost American businesses billions of dollars, he says, prohibited federal funding of IV drug users' needle distribution program, and initiated a six-month moratorium on needle exchange programs, also put a freeze on international family planning funds. And as Gary Ruskin of the Congressional Accountability Project told us, co-sponsor of the English First Bill, also the partial birth abortion ban, which is what the conservatives call it, the late-term abortion ban. And Gary Ruskin, you were just telling us about how he has stopped citizens from bringing ethics complaints in Congress.
Yeah, Livingston is very notable for this effort to really destroy or to weaken the institutions that police corruption in the Congress, both his assault on the Federal Election Commission, his assault on the House ethics process, which has led to a climate in the House of Representatives where corruption is increasingly possible. And he also, again, led this just astonishing assault on the Justice Department, and that he championed something that we call the Corrupt Politicians Protection Board. He, a strong supporter of this board, which would have, which was during this Congress, which would have helped shielded members of Congress from federal prosecution by helping them interfere with federal prosecutions by setting up a misconduct review board within the Justice Department with extremely broad subpoena powers to demand secret information about ongoing federal criminal investigations and to harass federal prosecutors, information which easily would have leaked to members of Congress facing federal prosecution. So he has this remarkable record of fighting against these institutions that are very important for policing corruption here in Washington. That I think, is his most important legislative activities. It's important, though, to say one good thing about Bob Livingston, I think, which is that he, unlike, in my view, the Speaker Gingrich had no redeeming qualities whatsoever. Livingston is an honest man, and he's widely liked both by reporters, I think, and by Democrats, some, and by outside groups, simply because he's a straight shooter. He is an honest man, and that will be a very big change in the House of Representatives from the Speaker, who would take these ridiculous spins and tacks and change and duck and weave every day.
What exactly, though, does honesty mean when, for example, he is stopping citizens of this country from finding out about how campaigns are financed of his colleagues in the House? Cutting the FEC press office may sound sort of mundane, but this is very significant. It's about how we get access to information about who is, well, I would call it bribing our Congress members.
Totally agree with that. I mean, his stance on these corruption matters have been absolutely abominable. He's really led this disgraceful effort to warfare on the institutions that police corruption in Congress. But at the same time, he's very straightforward about it. He doesn't lie. He doesn't duck and weave. He'll just tell you exactly what he thinks, and that is a welcome change. I've certainly fought him for years over these efforts to try to weaken these very fragile bodies that really help democracy work here in Washington. But he's very different from a guy like the Speaker.
Gary Ruskin, finally, have you been surprised by the events of the last few days?
Greatly surprised. I don't think anybody was knew that the Speaker, Gingrich, was going to resign, and particularly that he would fold so quickly after the election. Nobody would have thought that Monica Lewinsky would end up taking out Speaker Gingrich and not the president.
Well, on that note, I thank you very much for joining us, Gary Ruskin of the Congressional Accountability Project. If people want to get in touch with your group, where can they call or where can they go on the web?
They can call 202-296-2787. The web address is long. It's http://www.essential.org/ORGS/CAP/CAP.HTML, but it's the Congressional Accountability Project.
And again, the phone number?
202-296-2787.
I want to thank you very much again, Gary Ruskin of the Congressional Accountability Project, here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
They used to tell me I was building a tree. And so I followed the mob. And now was earth to plow or guns to bear. I was always there, right there on the charm. Once I built
waits, singing Yip Harburg's words, "Brother, can you spare a dime?" And oh, how my father loved those words. My father, George Goodman, died October 27th of a massive brain hemorrhage. He was 70 years old. But enough about his death. Today, I wanted to pay tribute to my dad, pay tribute to his life. He was a lifelong fan of Yip Harburg. Yip Harburg is someone we brought to the Pacifica listeners just a year ago, really because of my dad, because he introduced me to Yip Harburg, who was a lyricist, wrote the words to Brother Can You Spare a Dime, as well as all the words to the songs and Finian's Rainbow, as well as The Wizard of Oz. His words are, his name isn't known very well, but his songs are sung all over the world. And I thought I'd start the tribute with a poem that was written by Yip Harburg in 1981, just a month before he died at the age of 85. It's called Time, You Old Gypsy Man. Time, you old gypsy man, thief on the wing, drugged me with rhapsodies, tripped me with spring, fiddled me off my feet, danced me on air, sprinkled my daydreams with gold dust, then silvered my hair. Silvered my hair, you rogue, crinkled my eyes, whistled the bird of youth out of my skies. Time, you old vagabond, riddle me this. What did you do with forever and ever that sealed every kiss? You packed up your tambourines, stilled your guitars, slipped off into the night, turned off the stars, took away song and spring, robbed me of rhyme, fled in your carnival caravan. But you old gypsy man, thanks for a glorious time. Well, we also have to thank for that glorious time, because I feel like those words could be my father's as well. It was one of his favorite poems. We also have to thank for that glorious time my father had for 70 years. Thank my mother, Dari Goodman, who was with him for 47 years. They met when she was 14 and he was 15 at a camp. The first year she was voted most serious and he didn't even pay attention. But the next year when she was voted camp clown, well, then he started to check her out. They had their first date when she was 18. He invited her up for a college football weekend. And that weekend, well, rumor has it they had a terrific time, such a good time that when he put her on the train on Sunday to go home to Brooklyn, he sent a telegram to her mother, my grandmother, who's still alive today at the age of 101. He sent a telegram to her that said, "Have food ready." That's right. My father had forgotten to feed my mother on that first date, though I understand they had a wonderful feast that weekend. Well, that's how they met, and they got married in 1951 and embarked on a really incredible life together, a 47-year partnership filled with love and respect. My father went, after training as an eye doctor, to the National Institutes of Health. I was born in Washington, D.C. when he was working there, and he was tapped to be head of the National Institute of Blindness, now the National Eye Institute, which is part of the NIH. But he decided to give that up, and it's certainly a loss to the vision of this nation, when he wanted to go into private practice so that he could spend more time with his family and contribute more to a local community. And so my parents and my brother and I moved up to Long Island, New York, where my father practiced for more than 30 years. He also was a very avid community activist, along with my mother, a peace activist, was active in the group Physicians for Social Responsibility, and also served on our library board, the Bayshore Brightwaters Library, for more than two decades, believing deeply in equal opportunity for all and education for all. And he was the head of a task force in Bayshore that led to the integration of the schools, like so many communities around the country. We lived in de facto segregation, African Americans on one side of the tracks and whites on the other. My father felt very strongly that in education, we all had to be together, and that's what happened in our community. My father then went on, after being a doctor for many years, he retired, and he and my mother moved out to Stony Brook, where the State University of New York at Stony Brook is, and there they became very active participants in the Stony Brook Roundtable. This phenomenon of senior education is happening all over the country, and he was a devotee of it. Every Tuesday morning, he led the News of the Day Roundtable, where a group of about 50 to 100 senior citizens, retired people from all walks of life, discuss the news of the day. Just last Tuesday, after my dad died, one of my brothers and I went over to the round table where we heard his co-convener, Stan Green, talking about Pinochet and what was happening with him in Britain, and talking about the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. This is just a phenomenon that is happening, as I said, all over the country, and is something we all have to watch and document, and that is millions of people who are now at retirement age have 30 and 40 years ahead of them of active minds, tremendous experience, and in some ways I'd say they're beginning to take over the universities at Stony Brook and Long Island. They are taking over buildings because so many active participants want to continue their education. Well, just last Tuesday, my mother and father left the Stony Brook Roundtable. This is just hours before he died, and they walk through the campus singing Old Devil Moon, also by Yip Harburg, although their favorite song of Yip Harburg's was Look to the Rainbow.
On the day I was born, said my father, said he, an elegant legacy waiting for ye. 'Tis a rhyme for your lips and a song for your heart to sing it whenever the world falls apart. Look, look, look to rainbow, follow it over the hills and the stream. Look, look, look to the rainbow, follow the fellow who follows a dream.
Well, my dad, George Goodman, was certainly one fellow who followed a dream and inspired me and my three brothers and so many in our community to follow that dream of social justice and equality. And I hope we can live up to his name. My father had multiple sclerosis, and in his later years, he was in a wheelchair. And I watched with tremendous admiration as my mother and father dealt with this, how they worked it out. And even at the end of my father's life, as my mother had to help him out in the morning, even dressing him, my father was extremely independent. And once in that wheelchair, that scooter, he would scoot off to classes and to inspire so many other people and to share in their stories about their family, just as he had shared with his patients for so many years. My father was a man of tremendous dignity. One thing I have to take issue with, though, in the last week of sitting Shiva, the mourning period for Jews when someone dies, and so many people told me that they had never heard my father raise his voice. Well, I actually did get a chance to hear his voice raised, and that was when Alan and I went to Indonesia for the last time in 1994. I think my father had a pretty good sense that we were going to head off to East Timor, and he was quite afraid of that. And one night in Jakarta, don't ask me how he found us. He found our phone number and called and didn't ask to speak to me, but asked to speak to Alan. And I watched as Alan's eyes got rounder and bigger and rounder as my father raised his voice and said something like, well, you could only imagine, yes, he was very protective about making sure that I remained alive. And my father was able to do something that the entire Indonesian army had never been able to do, and that was instill fear in Alan Nairn. So my father has raised his voice, but for good reason, and he has done it to protect his family and also to protect his community and stand up for what he believed was right. It's hard to think of my father gone or not listening to this program, and I know in some way he probably still is, but I don't really think of him as gone, as he will continue to live on in all of us. And so I wanted to end with this poem that my mother had always next to her father's picture. We couldn't find it on the day of the funeral. My brother David went to the internet, something my father couldn't stand. The internet felt it depersonalized and even, or further depersonalized, a very impersonal world. But within minutes, we did find this poem, and that's what I wanted to end with today. Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. I am a thousand winds that blow. I am the diamond glints on snow. I am the sunlight on ripened grain. I am the gentle autumn rain. When you awaken in the morning's hush, I am the swift uplifting rush of quiet birds and circling flight. I am the soft star that shines at night. Do not stand at my grave and cry. I am not there. I did not die. My father, George Goodman, was born October 6, 1928, died October 27, 1998. We'll always love you and hopefully, to the best of our ability, carry on your dream. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
On the day born, said my father, said he, I've an elegant legacy waiting for ye. 'Tis a rhyme for your lips and a song for your heart to sing it whenever the world falls apart. Look, look, look to the rainbow. Follow it over the hills and the stream. Look, look, look to the rainbow.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Justice Department said yesterday it's looked into the possibility of extraditing former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet to the United States in connection with the 1976 assassination of Orlando Letelier, a Chilean diplomat who is in exile here, and Ronnie Moffitt, his American assistant, who were killed by a car bomb as they drove down Massachusetts Avenue in Washington, D.C. A Justice Department spokesperson said no decision has yet been made, but added it was unlikely that the discussions would go anywhere. Justice officials are also looking into Pinochet's responsibility into the deaths of two other Americans killed in Chile in the aftermath of the 1973 coup led by Pinochet, Charles Horman, portrayed in the movie Missing, and Frank Teruggi. A group of Chilean exiles in New York filed a formal petition with Attorney General Janet Reno requesting that the U.S. investigate the deaths and bring charges against Pinochet. In an article in this Saturday's New York Times, a U.S. Army official spoke against extraditing Pinochet, saying it could possibly lead to the declassification of thousands of U.S. documents outlining U.S. support for the dictator. As Britain's House of the Lords continue with hearings today on Pinochet's possible extradition to Spain, We talked today to Reed Brody, Legislative Director of Human Rights Watch, who is at the hearings in London. He has just stepped out. We'll then be joined by two victims of the Pinochet regime, the sister of Orlando Letelier and the father of Ronnie Moffitt. But Reed Brody, first to you in London. You've just stepped out of the hearing. Can you tell us what's happened?
Hi, Amy. Yes, the five law lords who are hearing an appeal from a decision by England's High Court quashing the warrant against Augusto Pinochet on the grounds that he is entitled to absolute immunity as the head of state. The lawyers for the British government who represent the Spanish authority, as well as interveners for Amnesty International and other human rights groups and victims, are arguing that under international law, since Nuremberg and through today, through the establishment of an international criminal court, that immunity for head of state for crimes such as torture, crimes against humanity, murder, and disappearances is absolutely antiquated. And they're urging the five lords to reverse the decision and hold Pinochet so that they can hear the extradition request from Spain.
And so what do you expect will happen now?
Well, the arguments are now in their third day. They'll probably go to tomorrow and maybe the day after. They're all arguments on the law, on how international law has developed, on what states are doing these days, as opposed to the antiquated doctrine that equated the sovereign with the state and granted him immunity. And so it's quite possible that at the end of this, the five judges who are very engaged in the arguments that are going on now may reverse that decision. We really don't know.
Hmm. Well, Reed Brody, we're joined right now, as we said, by two people who are very close to the Pinochet regime, unfortunately, whether they like it or not. And that is Murray Carpin, father of Ronnie Moffitt, killed along with Orlando Letelier in 1976 on a Washington street. It is clear that Chilean agents of the Pinochet regime were responsible for her death and Orlando Letelier's death. We're also joined from Santiago, Chile, by Fabiola Letelier, who is the sister of Orlando Letelier. And she organized a protest that was supposed to take place yesterday. More than 50,000 people were expected to demonstrate for the extradition of Pinochet to Spain in Santiago, but the government prohibited that demonstration from taking place. Let's begin with you, Fabiola Letelier. Can you tell us what happened?
As you have mentioned, at the last minute, the authorities of the government cancel the approval of this public manifestation that was called by a group of members of the House of Representatives, members of the Democratic Christian Democratic Party and Socialist Party, and that manifestation was supported by all the human rights organizations and, of course, for many, many social organizations. And it was in the last minute because we were in a press conference with many journalists, members of different media, and in that moment we knew that the manifestation, the public manifestation, was canceled. This was a very serious situation for us, because we really wanted to make public our opposition of the activities that have made the government to pretend to obtain for Pinochet impunity.
Let me ask you something, Fabiola Letelier. You are a human rights attorney. You've litigated your brother's case for 15 years in Chilean courts. The Chilean government is lobbying to have Pinochet released on humanitarian grounds. What is your reaction to that? They've even lobbied the Vatican to put pressure on Britain to have him released on humanitarian grounds.
You know, we have opposed to this petition because for humanitarian reasons, because Pinochet, with his military regime, never had any kind of humanitarian action with the opponents that were in prison. You know, there are in the report of the National Truth and Reconciliation Commission that it is was given to the public during the Elwin government, that there are a lot of people that are of more than 70 years old, and all these people was executed by Pinochet. As you know, the illicit conduct of Pinochet not only affected Chilean citizens, but also citizens of other countries, and his criminal activities extended beyond Chile's border to the United States, as you mentioned, with the case of Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Murphy, to Italy with the unsuccessful attempt on the life of the former vice president of Chile, Bernardo Leighton, and to Argentina with the homicide of the former army commander-in-chief, Carlos Prats González. And all these acts of terrorism carried out by agents of his principal repressive service, the National Intelligence Administration, DINA, this crime and many others carried out abroad were committed under the what has been known Operación Cóndor, which linked repressive apparatus in Latin American southern cone military dictatorship in the 1970s for the purpose of eliminating opponents to those regimes and those who fought for the restoration of democracy. So Pinochet now in Spain is facing a judgment for genocide, torture, and international terrorism. Mm. And the 70% of the Chilean wants really that he will be extradited to Spain to face a very important judgment with the respect of the law.
You're listening. You're listening to Fabiola Letelier, sister of Orlando Letelier. I just wanted to bring in Murray Carpin, who is the father of Ronnie Moffat, who died along with Orlando Letelier, the Chilean diplomat in exile in Washington in 1976. Ronnie Moffat, the American researcher and assistant. Murray Carpin, this Saturday New York Times article quotes a U.S. Army official speaking against extraditing Pinochet to the United States, saying that it could possibly lead to the declassification of thousands of U.S. documents outlining U.S. support for the dictator. The U.S. trained the Chilean secret police, for example, until 1977. What are your thoughts on that?
It's probably true. We have pushed democracy in all countries, and yet we backed a revolution that destroyed the second oldest democracy in the Western Hemisphere. Chile had become a democracy in 1840s or 1850s. We destroyed it because President Nixon was unhappy that he could not help his friend and from Anaconda Copper. It's quite obvious that, to my mind anyway, that the that our government or people in our government had to have known that the murder or something was going to be done in the United States. We set up DINA, and we had agents in DINA.
The Chilean secret police.
Yes, and we had our agents from the CIA had to have known something was happening. More than that, of course, is the fact that we bankrolled both the election when Allende won, and we bankrolled the overthrow of the government. We gave them guns, and we gave them advice. Chile, after all, the day after the revolution, had a functioning secret police. It didn't happen by accident, and it had to take a lot of time, and the Chileans did not know how to do this. I think our government is not going to do anything, because if they do, if they release all the information, it will be very, very, very embarrassing.
But this case is being included in the Spanish cases, the case of Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt that have been brought, are part of the extradition request by the Spanish judge. Fabiola Letelier, can you explain how it falls under the Spanish jurisdiction?
The Spanish jurisdiction is the competence of this tribunal in Spain. Is for genocide, for terrorism, and of course includes the cases of Orlando Letelier and many others. And as I know, some authorities, American authorities, have contributed with some material that has been declassified. Also, Barcella, that was one of the prosecutors in American prosecutor in the case of Letelier, he made a declaration before a lawyer, attorney in law, that went to the United States. And I know that there are some materials declassified that comes from the United States included in the procedure in Spain. And really, I think this is very important, but of course, will be very significant, relevant, that the American authorities of the Department of Justice and others can give more information to the Spanish Baltasar Garzón. So this will be a great help. But also, I really believe that the American authority can ask for the extradition of Pinochet to the United States, because the murder of Ronnie Moffitt to this moment has been not judged by the real good tribunal.
Do you see, Reed Brody, though you're in London, you're a human rights attorney based here in the United States, the possibility of the U.S. either extraditing, asking for the extradition of Pinochet, or releasing these documents that would explain what happened in 1976, not to mention through the period of the coup of 1973?
Well, there are several things the U.S. could do but has not.
And that is, well, so much for a cellular phone in London. Do you see, let me end with Murray Carpin, father of Ronnie Moffitt, that possibility? And have you gotten any of the documents yourself? Because it is your daughter who died on U.S. soil as a result of Chilean agents.
I have not sought the documents because I know in my heart that the government is never going to release this information, because it will be extremely embarrassing. They destroyed a democracy. Put in a dictator in the name of democracy? I can't understand that.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Murray Carpin, father of Ronnie Moffitt, killed along with the Chilean diplomat in exile Orlando Letelier on a Washington street in 1976. We will continue to cover the latest developments. Today, the British House of Lords continuing hearings on Pinochet's possible extradition to Spain. Thanks to Reed Brody, Fabiola Letelier, and Murray Carpin for being with us. If you'd like a copy of today's program, you can order a cassette from the Pacifica Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow, we bring you a special on the third anniversary of the execution of Ogoni activist Ken Sarawiwa in Nigeria. We will bring you an interview with Ken Sarawiwa's father that we were able to do in Nigeria just a few weeks ago in Ogoni land. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill and Maria Carrion. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Joe Gill engineered from Washington, D.C. Julie Drizin's our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!